I am Dr. Rapp, and this is Appreciating Shakespeare, Series 2, Podcast S, Henry IV, Part 2. Henry IV, Part 2 brings to dramatic completion the plan of Prince Hal for his public transformation on his acceding to the throne. In verse and prose that richly represent the mastery of the incarnational style of Shakespeare's mature period, which I discussed in Session 3 of Chapter 1 in Series 1, the play takes us inexorably toward the triumph of the good prince and the bending of all England toward justice under his government. This movement is prepared for by a variety of pictures of uncertainty in all main characters but the prince, all reinforcing the need for a strong and just leader to restore and secure the health of the Commonwealth of England. The play is built on the movement from these initial uncertainties to their resolution in four dramatic confrontations: Prince John's bloodless defeat of the rebels, the final reconciliation of King Henry and Prince Hal, the new King Henry V's surprise approval of the Chief Justice, and his just but merciful banishment of Falstaff from his presence. The uncertainty to which the accession of Prince Hal to the throne puts an end is conveyed in several ways. First, the play begins with an induction, which we would call an introduction, by the abstract character Rumor, whose costume is painted with tongues. Rumor is called a pipe blown by surmises, jealousies, conjectures, induction lines 15 to 16. Jealousies here means suspicions. This character of Rumor serves a triple function. It reminds us that at the end of Part 1, Prince Hal defeated Hotspur's rebellion. It announces that it will be sending false news of that defeat to Northumberland and others, and it conveys the confusion of the time by being itself the bearer of both truth and falsehood. Uncertainty and confusion govern Northumberland in his effort to continue the rebellion against Henry IV. He flies into a desperate passion on hearing that Hotspur is dead, Act 1, Scene 1, lines 136 to 160, then determines to gather forces to fight the king, lines 212 to 215, then is said to be an uncertain prop for the rebellion fostered by the Archbishop of York, Act 1, Scene 3, lines 18 to 33, and finally, though he says he wants to join the Archbishop's forces, instead chooses to escape to Scotland, Act 2, Scene 3, line 67. He is joined in these uncertainties in Act 1, Scene 3, by the Archbishop and those of his faction. Are they sufficient with Northumberland to stand against the king's forces? Are they sufficient without him? Will the king bring all his forces against them, or divide his armies, and so on. In his own expression of uncertainty at lines 87 to 108, the Archbishop includes all the people of England, who, he says, once rejected Richard and are now fed up with Henry. The Commonwealth is sick of their own choice. Their over-greedy love hath surfeited. What trust is in these times? Past and to come seems best, things present worst. The king himself is also filled with uncertainty and confusion, concluding his meditation on his own lack of repose due to care with the famous line, "Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown," Act 3, Scene 1, line 31. He laments at lines 76 to 77 that Northumberland, who supported him in deposing Richard II, has now, 8 years later, turned against him, fulfilling Richard's prophecy. The time will come that foul sin gathering head shall break into corruption. Gathering head means gathering up forces, in particular gathering armies. Then he introduces the question of to what degree the events of history are a function of necessity. At lines 72 to 74, he observes about his deposing Richard and becoming king, "Though then, God knows, I had no such intent, but that necessity so bowed the state that I and greatness were compelled to kiss. At lines 80 to 92, Warwick, spelled W-A-R-W-I-C-K, adds that Richard might well have prophesied correctly, because events of the past determine by necessity events yet to come. To this the king replies, "Are these things then necessities? Then let us meet them like necessities." This universal question, whether our own actions and historical events are functions of will or of necessity, is laced through the play. Its focus here is the effects of political uncertainty in the absence of a God-established monarch, whom it is every man's duty to obey, and of a clear picture of where virtue lies. Necessity may be appealed to by both the virtuous, like King Henry IV, and the self-indulgent, like the Archbishop of York, or Falstaff. The quandary of the Duke of York and Richard II, how long to remain loyal to the rightful but destructive king, when to switch loyalty to the competent but usurping king, becomes the universal quandary of England, now divided by civil wars. In his confusion, King Henry II, like Richard in Richard II, is England in little. In Act 4, Scene 4, the king's inner conflict reaches its peak, taking the form of physical sickness, even as he hears good news of the success of his troops against the rebels. The witty self-indulgence that fills the Falstaff scenes of the play reinforces the confusion and uncertainty of England in its riffraff as in its aristocrats. The wit of Falstaff is of wider scope than in Part I, but rings with less joyful hilarity, partly because of the distance from him of Prince Hal. The two appear together in this play only in Act 2, Scene 4, and in the great rejection scene of Act 5, Scene 5. Falstaff is as witty as ever, but exercises his wit no longer under the protective covering of the prince's plan to appear dissolute. Instead, he is set against such sober and unsusceptible men as the Chief Justice, Westmoreland, and Prince John of Lancaster, that is, the forces of justice in the realm and the true company of the future King Henry V. This change from Part I builds into the structure the sense that, as the king sickens, the prince is moving away from Falstaff toward assuming, with virtue, the royal mantle of his destiny. The threat of the passage of time and aging hangs more threateningly over Falstaff in Part II, as it does over the king. At Act 2, Scene 4, Line 271, Falstaff says, "I am old, I am old." And at Act 4, Scene 5, Lines 216 to 217, the king says, "More would I say, but my lungs are wasted so that strength of speech is utterly denied me." There are many references to the past in the play, to scenes from Richard II, the interrupted trial by combat, the corruption and deposition of the king, the shady paths of Bolingbroke, to the battle at Shrewsbury in Part I, to Falstaff's and Shallow's youths, and the future that the king intended, to fight for the Holy Land and die in Jerusalem as prophesied, shrinks to a room in the palace, historically a hall next to Westminster Abbey, called Jerusalem. Time in this play leads us inexorably toward the inevitable disappointment of Falstaff's perverse hopes, and the fulfillment of the king's good hopes in the dramatic triumphs of the prince. To return to Falstaff, his scenes are a riot of wit devoted to the self-indulgent corruption of himself and his cronies, the braggart pistol, the foolish hostess Quickly, the immoral doll Tearsheet, the alcoholic Bardolph, and in the latter scenes the unethical self-indulgences of the king's justice of the peace Shallow and his time-pleasing servant Davy. The events involve brawling, drinking, fornicating, sentimentality, wishful thinking, and corruption of the king's press, the commissioned power to draft men for the army. Falstaff observes about Shallow at Act 5, Scene 1, lines 64 to 67, "It is a wonderful thing to see the semblable coherence of his men's," meaning his servants' "spirits and his. They, by observing him, do bear themselves like foolish justices. He, by conversing with them, is turned into a justice-like serving man. Their spirits are so married in conjunction with the participation of society that they flock together in consent like so many wild geese. It is certain that either wise bearing or ignorant carriage is caught as men take diseases one of another." This observation is partly true. The company one keeps influences one's character and behavior. It is also true of himself and those with whom he keeps company. In fact, in duping Shallow, Falstaff will be as venal as Shallow, though more clever. But the mutually corrupting influence of Falstaff and Shallow and their fellow dissolutes is the shadow of Prince Hal's mission to influence his subjects in a positive direction by his own behavior. At the same time, the influence of society is not merely a function of necessity. That man still has free will is illustrated by the few examples of virtue amidst the vice-ridden. Among the foolish, venal, and cowardly Shallow and Falstaff and their army recruits, one man stands as a contrast with them, despite his unprepossessing stature. In Act 3, Scene 2, when the stout bullcalf buys his way out of military service, it is ironically the weakling, feeble, of all people, who submits to being drafted, saying at lines 234 to 238, "A man can die but once. We owe God a death. I'll ne'er bear a base mind. An it be my destiny, so. An it be not, so. No man's too good to serve his prince, and let it go which way it will, he that dies this year is quit for the next." This simple philosophical humility shows virtuous courage to be the antidote to the tyranny of necessity. I will return to Feeble briefly in specific note 4. Thanks to the similar, if more savvy, virtues of Prince Hal and his brother Prince John, all of these confusions, rumor, Northumberland's vacillations, the rebel leader's uncertainties, the king's troubles and illness, and the corruption among the commoners, are healingly resolved by the four dramatic triumphs of the play. The first is the triumph of Prince John and Westmoreland over the rebels at Galtree Forest. Modern critics have had a field day in accusing Prince John of Machiavellian larceny, injustice, immorality, and cynicism in seeming to swear to redress the wrongs of the Archbishop and his fellow rebels, and then seeming to go back on his word. It is true that at Act 4, Scene 2, line 59, Prince John equivocates with, "My lord, these griefs shall be with speed redressed," and at line 75 to 76, "My love to ye shall show itself more openly hereafter." But the rebels have evoked his treatment of them. Being traitors, they can experience justice only as treachery. And John's equivocation, like Prince Hal's low-life disguise, is justified by his higher purpose. The criticism of the critics is just that of the rebels themselves, at lines 110 and 112. Mowbray, "Is this proceeding just and honorable?" Archbishop, "Will you thus break your faith?" To these accusations, Prince John replies with perfect honesty, "I pawned thee none. I promised you redress of these same grievances, whereof you did complain, which, by mine honor, I will perform with a most Christian care. But for you rebels, look to taste the dew meet for rebellion." Lines 112 to 117. He is completely justified. The legitimate grievances the rebels put forward in the negotiations, Prince John will indeed redress. but no such grievances justify the taking up of arms against the king. And the critics ignore the actual outcome. John has concluded a peaceful resolution of the conflict without the loss of a drop of blood except that of the rebel leaders, who are properly executed for treason against the king, as they knew they would be if the battle were fought and lost. As John says, confusion and folly lay in the very plan to oppose an army against the king, and that folly was completed in the folly of sending the rebel armies away, lines 118 to 119. When he says, God and not we hath safely fought today, line 121, we are meant to agree with him. Prince John is an instrument of the good of the Commonwealth, and his mastery of the day without bloodshed is a major turning point toward the just government of Henry V. As a footnote, I will quote Philip Thompson's refutation of the erroneous criticism of Prince John. Here, as in the case of Measure for Measure, the critical habit of opposing sympathetic characters to unsympathetic ones, Falstaff versus Prince John, Prince Hal versus King Henry V, the deposed Richard to Bolingbroke, and Claudio versus Isabella in Measure for Measure, implies the notion that Shakespeare should have been celebrating modern sympathies, which are with unyoked humors, a phrase from Henry IV, Part 1, Act 1, Scene 2, line 196, and emphatically not with the Commonwealth that is his theme in these plays. The result is that their action as a whole is ignored, and their incidents are used merely to judge individual characters in the way acquaintances might be judged. Does he read? Is he funny? Does he see both sides of a question? Is he all business? Etc. When Prince John, by a ruse, spares both armies and then executes the rebel leaders, he is judged to be an unworthy tavern companion. The tavern is not Shakespeare's ideal world, and he means what Prince John says about traitors. Liberation from battle is what the verse emphasizes. Mine ease at mine inn, a phrase from Henry IV, Part 1, Act 3, Scene 3, lines 80 to 81, is a pleasure, not an ideal. The second major dramatic triumph of Henry IV, Part 2, comes in Act 4, Scene 5, with Prince Hal's contemplation of the crown in the presence of the sleeping Henry IV, who, he thinks, has died, and the following reconciliation between father and son. First, Prince Hal acknowledges that the crown is a polished perturbation, line 23, just as Henry IV had felt in Act 3, Scene 1. Then the prince, thinking his father is dead, puts the crown on his head, not in eagerness or pride, but A, to try with it as with an enemy that had before my face murdered my father, lines 166 to 167. That is, to test himself against its physical, political, and moral weight. And B, to acknowledge that he inherits it and will pass it on to his heirs legitimately. Lo, where it sits, that is, on his own head, which God shall guard, and put the world's whole strength into one giant arm, it shall not force this lineal honor from me. This from thee will I to mine leave, as 'tis left to me. Lines 43 to 46. Put the world's whole strength means, let the whole world's strength be put, that is, even if it were put. With these words, Prince Hal expresses the determination to expiate any illegitimacy in his father's taking the crown from Richard II. When the king awakens, and once again, as in Henry IV, Part 1, Act 3, Scene 2, accuses the prince of having the dissolute behavior and character of Richard II, lines 92 to 137, the prince movingly proclaims, "The noble change that I have purposed," line 154. The king is persuaded and advises his son to busy giddy minds with foreign quarrels, lines 213 to 214, in order to distract the nation from any remaining doubts about Lancastrian legitimacy. The prince then confirms his intention rightfully to maintain his hold on the crown, lines 220 to 224. The third major triumph of the play takes place in Act 5, Scene 2, when the new king's brothers and courtiers, including the chief justice, who once had put Prince Hal in jail for striking him, express fear about Henry V's character and likely behavior. Will he be another Richard II, dissolute and destructive to the realm and to justice? We are then treated to the great pleasure of seeing those fears melt away with the honorable and healing words of Henry V at lines 47 to 49. This is the English, not the Turkish court. Not Amurath and Amurath succeeds, but Harry, Harry. In the exchange with the Chief Justice, we experience the birth of the wise and just ruler we have all along known to be gestating in Prince Hal. The justice tempered with mercy of Henry V is confirmed and dramatized in the final triumph of this play at Act 5, Scene 5, lines 63 to 65, the 10-mile banishment of Falstaff from the king's presence. It is important to remember, lest we jump on the bandwagon of critics who disapprove of Henry's behavior, that the moment he has learned of the death of Henry IV, Falstaff, at Act 5, Scene 3, lines 130 to 138, says, "I am fortune's steward. Let us take any man's horses. The laws of England are at my commandment. Blessed are they that have been my friends, and woe to my Lord Chief Justice." In other words, Falstaff believes that his misrule will be the rule in England now that his supposed protege will be king. When the newly crowned Henry V says, "I know thee not, old man, fall to thy prayers," Act 5, Scene 5, line 47, we empathize with Falstaff's disappointment, but we must not be surprised or disapproving. We must, like all the virtuous of England, be relieved and uplifted. Henry is not being cruel. He has warned Falstaff, the old white-bearded Satan, as Hal calls Falstaff in Henry IV, Part 1, at Act 2, Scene 4, line 463, warned him again and again what he is facing if he doesn't mend. Recall Prince Hal's "I do, I will," in Henry IV, Part 1, at Act 2, Scene 4, line 481. Here, at Act 5, Scene 5, line 66 to 70, Henry mercifully provides Falstaff a stipend for competence of life, "that lack of means enforce you not to evils, and as we hear you do reform yourselves, we will, according to your strengths and qualities, give you advancement." But banish Falstaff from his own presence, Henry must. And in his doing so, his transformation before the eyes of the court and the multitudes is complete. His disguise of dissipation is shed, and the king under it is revealed to be the wise and just ruler for whom England has longed. Now here is one key line. In Act 2, Scene 2, Prince Hal reminds us of what was revealed about his purposes in his important soliloquy in Henry IV, Part 1, at Act 1, Scene 2, lines 195 to 217, namely, that his apparently dissolute behavior among the riffraff is a ruse. Here he says to Poins, "By this hand thou thinkest me as far in the devil's book as thou and Falstaff for obduracy and persistency. Let the end try the man," lines 45 to 47. That is, let him be judged by his ends, meaning A, his purposes, and B, the end of the story, when he becomes king. Later in the scene, after calling to mind Jupiter's disguising himself as a bull, he says of his own descent into disguise, "From a prince to apprentice, a low transformation. That shall be mine, for in everything the purpose must weigh with the folly," lines 174 to 176. That is, the folly will be justified when weighed in the balance against his ultimate purpose. Whereas Jupiter's descent was for the sake of self-indulgent lust, Hal's has been for the sake of the kingdom's good. Finally, the prince reminds us, when speaking for the last time with his dying father at Act 4, Scene 5, lines 151 to 154, that his supposed moral transformation will be a performance that he has always intended. If I do feign, that is, pretend to sorrow at thinking the king was dead, oh, let me in my present wildness die, and never live to show the incredulous world the noble change that I have purposed. Nothing in his actual character has needed transformation. It is only his outward behavior, which itself was a ruse, that will seem to change when he becomes king. Now, here are 7 specific notes to help you in your reading. Note 1. In Act 2, Scene 1, at line 74, appears the phrase, "He hath eaten me out of house and home." This phrase and others like it have been found earlier, but its wide popularity in recent centuries can be attributed to this use of it by Hostis Quickly. Note 2. At Act 1, Scene 2, lines 66 and following, Falstaff had pretended to be deaf and engaged in a contest of wits with the Chief Justice. Then, at Act 2, Scene 1, lines 166 and following, after the Chief Justice, discussing important matters with Gower, pays no attention to Falstaff's attempt to horn in on the conversation, Falstaff in turn pretends to ignore the Chief Justice when the latter speaks to him. At lines 191 to 193, Falstaff implies that he has learned this impolite behavior from the Chief Justice, and concludes, "This is the right fencing grace, my lord, tap for tap, and so part fair." That is, he has given the Chief Justice as good as he's gotten in the way of being ignored, and so they are even. All of this brazen disrespect for his superior, an outrage against hierarchy of both rank and character, is founded on Falstaff's belief that when Prince Hal becomes king, Falstaff will be able to do what he pleases, as summed up when he presumptuously predicts, "Woe to my Lord Chief Justice," at Act 5, Scene 3, line 138. Note 3. At Act 3, Scene 2, lines 36 to 38, Justice Shallow, after his commonplace observation on death, "To certain all shall die," referring to Psalm 89, verse 48, "What man liveth and shall not see death," ironically asks, "How a yoke of bullocks at Stamford Fair?" Meaning, how much does a pair of bullocks cost? He is unwittingly referring to the apocryphal book of Ecclesiasticus, also called the Book of Sirach, chapter 38, verse 25, which reads in the King James Version, "How can he get wisdom that holdeth the plough, and whose talk is of bullocks?" The implication is that wisdom will forever escape Shallow, who moves so quickly from contemplating death in trite terms to discussing the price of cattle. Note 4. At Act 3, Scene 2, line 160, note the use of oxymorons, "wrathful dove," or "most magnanimous mouse," about Feeble, who is himself an oxymoron, strength of character in a weak body. Note 5. At Act 4, Scene 1, line 69, the Archbishop of York says that the rebels find our griefs heavier than our offenses. He means the grievances against the king justify the offense of mounting the rebellion. Prince John, though he will strive to redress the grievances, will properly disagree that they justify plunging the country into civil war. Note 6. At Act 4, Scene 3, line 86, after Prince John has said that he will speak about Falstaff better than he deserves, Falstaff hilariously replies, after the prince exits, "I would you had but the wit." That is, if only you had the wit to speak of me better than I deserve. He means, A, facetiously, that he deserves so much that it would be hard to exaggerate it, and B, seriously, that he would stand to gain if only the prince would recommend him. Falstaff goes on to complain that Prince John cannot be made to laugh, as his brother Prince Hal can, or anyway could in Henry IV Part I, because John drinks no wine. We may sympathize with Falstaff's assessment of Prince John, but are certainly not meant to approve of it. Note 7. At Act 5, Scene 3, lines 134 to 135, we get the phrase, "Boot, boot, Master Shallow." The line is a triple pun on the word boot. It means, A, footwear, that is, put on your boots, because I am in a hurry to get to the new king. B, benefit, as in, benefit me, serve me, help me, perhaps with the £1,000 that he borrows from Shallow. And C, booty, promised advantages and rewards that you will reap for being my crony when I come to London and get the king to do my bidding. I am Dr. Rapp, and this is Appreciating Shakespeare.